Hello, this is Scott Fraioli from buyandselldvc.com. We are a Disney Vacation Club resale company. Everyone has been in the parks or at the resorts and seen Disney's best-kept secret, which is their Disney Vacation Club system. However, instead of buying directly from Disney, you could purchase the same contracts on the resale market. This is where people who are no longer interested in owning sell their contracts, and you can many times save half of what Disney charges. Again, that's www.buyandselldvc.com. or search on Facebook for Buy and Sell DVC.
Welcome to Walt Disney's Carousel of Progress. You're in for a real treat. The Carousel of Progress was Walt's own idea from beginning to end. He loved it. He introduced the show at World's Fair in New York City in 1964, and it was an immediate smash hit. Millions of people came to see it, and since then, the Carousel of Progress has had more performances than any other stage show in the history of American theater. You know, Walt loved the idea of progress, and he loved the American family. He himself was probably as American as anyone could possibly be. He thought it would be fun to watch the American family go through the 20th century, experiencing all new wonders as they came. And he put them together in a show called Carousel of Progress, which we are about to see. Although our Carousel family has experienced a few changes over the years, our show still revolves around the same theme, and that's progress. May the century begin.
Hello, welcome to a special episode of the DubDub Review. I'm your host, Chris Malik, and I'm joined by my friend, Tim Van Swole. Tim, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So, Tim, thank you for joining me today. Pete and Stacy are both busy working, and, you know, I wanted to have you on because, honestly, we were inspired by Jim Corcus' show on how to be a Disney historian. And so we set forth an idea of something we wanted to accomplish. That sounds kind of Waltish right there too, doesn't it? The actual phrase, right? A little bit like Walt. We set forth, you know, an idea of what we wanted to accomplish. And what we wanted to do was dive a little deeper into some of the cooler historical aspects of Walt Disney World and Disneyland and Walt himself. So we want to start a segment. It's going to be a regular piece. And I can't say that it's going to be every week, but we're going to try and put them out as frequently as we could do the research for them. And we're going to call it the DSI, and that's the Dubs Scene Investigation. And Tim, you, my friend, were one of the first responders, and I appreciate that, which means you're my... How can we use the word? Is the word guinea pig, Tim? Is that too sharp of a word?
No, it kind of feels like I'm a guinea pig. I think that's fair.
All right, so you're the guinea pig. So, Tim, do you want to let us know what we're going to talk about today?
Well, sure. Let me start off, though, by asking you a question. What attraction at Walt Disney World, Chris, do you think the guests most associate with Walt Disney himself?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Okay, so let's think about this logically. So we're going to take away anything that's at Animal Kingdom and Epcot and the studios. So we're going to eliminate those right off the bat. We're going to go to Magic Kingdom because that has the longest lineage. So, okay, I would think potentially the trains because he was so big into trains, possibly. But I don't know if that would really qualify as an attraction. It would, but I don't know if that grabs people's mind. I also think of Walt with the Tiki Birds as I could see the picture in my head where he's got his hands up kind of pointing towards the Tiki Birds. So potentially, but that was the Disneyland version, not the Walt Disney World version.
Right.
The Pirates, you know, I know that was one of his, he definitely had his hands deep into that project, and I know he really loved that attraction. But what do you think? Where are you going with this, buddy? Which one is on top of your mind here?
Well, today we're going to be talking about the Carousel of Progress. And I think most people tend to associate the Carousel of Progress most directly with Walt because it's hard to get every detail and know this every single piece, but it seems that this would be the one attraction that Walt was actually hands-on. We know for sure that Walt was hands-on with the development of the actual parts of the Carousel of Progress at Walt Disney World, because when it was developed for the 1964 New York World's Fair, he was part of that. Others were part of his vision, other attractions he was part of planning, but they ended up at Disneyland or they don't exist anymore. But Carousel of Progress seems to be the one that's most associated with him actually being hands-on with its development.
Okay. So this is really cool because I was hoping to contact you and put a tough one in your area, and this is going to be a tough one, but I'm really excited as well too. So before you even start, and I know you've done some research, tell me, so you're at the Magic Kingdom on any given day. In terms of must-do attractions, where does the Carousel of Progress like sit in the Van Swole family itinerary?
The Carousel of Progress is a must-do. I've been lucky enough that on all my trips, it has been open. It's never been closed for refurbishment during the time we were there, mm-hmm. and I would be devastated if it was. It is a must-do for me. I've gone on it with, you know, multiple times, sometimes by myself or with just one other member of my family, but I got to do it. It's a must-do. So,
and why is that? Tell me, why is it?
I feel connected to Walt, probably because of what we were just talking about. His hands-on, it's his vision. It is Walt's, in a nutshell, the Carousel of Progress and what he believed that America should be and where we should be going and what Disney World should be all about.
Okay. So let me tell you my version of that. And I agree with you. It is a must-do, and it's a must-do for a couple reasons. First off, and this is kind of an odd one. When you sit inside the theater, you know you're going to see something special because the theater moves. You know, the whole theater slides in a circle. So it's already pretty rare, and it's already pretty unique in its own right. And this is the weird part about it. The theater smells, but it doesn't smell bad. It's got like a unique... My descriptive words are falling away. It's got like a unique classic smell to it. Kind of like when you walk into like your grandma's apartment and like it smells like historical or it smells just different. You know, it has that feel when you walk into it that this isn't a prefabricated attraction. And I'm not knocking any of the, you know, Slinky Dog coasters or anything that comes out that feels like the next coaster. This just feels like a unique attraction that I can only see at Walt Disney World at Magic Kingdom. So when you're a kid, you're like, oh man, this is at least a break from the heat. It's like 23 minutes and thank goodness I'm in the air conditioning. And then the theater starts moving and like you listen to the music and you're snapping your fingers. And before you know it, you're already through the, you know, the 40s, the 60s, you know, you're halfway done or more. And you're like, this is awesome. I'm like learning about history and it's like entertaining at the same time. So yeah, I agree. It's always been one of my favorites. And I hope it never closes. I never hope it goes on long extended rehab. And like you, I've always been able to go and actually see it when I'm down there. And we'll do it once. We don't necessarily do it more than once, but we definitely will do it once.
Yep. It's a must-do. And it, when you're in it, it just feels like you're taken away to a happy, wonderful place and time.
Okay. So I know you've done a boatload of research. So for fear of ripping off Calgon's phrase, Calgon taking you away, Tim Van Swole, educate me on everything here for the Carousel of Progress, please.
All right. Well, to build off of that phrase, ripping off, I want to make sure that we acknowledge the resources that I've used. And I this is the boring part of the presentation, but I want to give credit to the sources that I used for my presentation. So It's a list of about 12 different things. So first one was a book I got that was called A Historical Tour of Walt Disney World by Andrew Kist. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. K-I-S-T-E. Another resource was a YouTube video. I watched the presentation called Disneyland Goes to the World's Fair that was hosted by Walt himself back when they were advertising it during the 1965.
I've watched it. I've watched it myself.
It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I did refer to multiple sources in Wikipedia to kind of double-check some things and cross-reference things. I also used the website Smithsonian Institution Archives on Walt Disney's Progress Land. There's another website called the NYWF64.com, which stands for New York World's Fair 64.com, that I referred to, and a lot of primary sources that were just images and pictures of things from that time, pamphlets and brochures and things. It was really interesting. Another one, the magic of WDW.com, which is where I got the script of the current Carousel of Progress that I referred to. MousePlanet.com provided a lot of articles, and I referred to a couple by our friend Jim Corcus. Specifically, one was called A Visit to Edison Square 1959 and Taking a Spin on the Carousel of Progress.
Tim, you could spend hours on Mouse Planet.
Oh, man. Yes, I could. It was like a rabbit hole I just couldn't get. DVD by Themeparkology on the production, or their production on the Carousel of Progress. And then on several other podcasts that I listened to. One was Retro Disney World Podcast. One was called the Unlocking the Magic Disney World Podcast. Wedway Radio Podcast. And Attraction Checklist Podcast. So all of those sources I give credit to, and I thank the contributors to that for the information that helped me to put together my research today.
And as you say that, everyone else who volunteered to help with this idea of ours, Tim, is like, oh, sweet googly moogly, I need to step up my game now. Tim's got a dozen resources. Okay, I'm sorry. Keep on going, buddy.
Okay. So I thought we'd start with, you know, like, where did Walt's inspiration for this come from? What started the Carousel of Progress? And I think we have to start with Walt loved miniatures and models. You mentioned the railroad before, his love of that, and it goes along with that. So in 1939, Walt visited the Golden Gate International Exposition in San Francisco, and he saw a miniatures display that was put on by Mrs. James Ward Thorne. She was married to the co-founder of Montgomery Ward's department stores. And he became fascinated with miniatures at that time. He just fell in love with them. Mm-hmm. He had also previously worked with some miniatures briefly when he was working with his nephew, Roy E. Disney, when they were putting together a Lionel train layout for him, for his train. And that inspired Walt to create the Carol Wood Pacific Railroad, which was a backyard railroad in his home. It was a 1-to-8 scale rideable train set. He took particular pride in that he himself had completed every aspect of the yellow caboose for the train all by himself.
Carolwood Pacific. Okay, so where, Tim, on property, is there the Carolwood Pacific room on Walt Disney World property?
Oh, wow. I don't know. You stumped me.
Come on now. Are you stumped? Do I have to take you there someday? We'll have to meet there?
Absolutely. I'm going to hold you to that.
At the very base of what used to be the DVC Villas at the Wilderness Lodge, now it's been renamed, there is a Carolwood Pacific room, and it actually has a couple of his trains under glass case, along with some other railroad paraphernalia from Walt's backyard.
Really? But
it's really beautiful. It's peaceful, dark woods. It's really serene. But yeah, some Disney artifacts down at the DVC at the Wilderness Lodge, the base of the actual DVC wing.
I'm going to have to get over there and check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's awesome. So he fell in love with the railroads through that. Then in the early 50s, Walt began working on a project of miniature dioramas that he wanted to depict life in an old Western town. He was determined that he was going to do this, and he wanted to do it himself. He had such grand plans that it turned out that he was going to need help on it anyway. But the first scene of the project in this was called Granny Kincaid's Cabin, and it was based on a set from a Disney's live action feature, which was called So Dear to My Heart. And Granny Kincaid's Cabin was exhibited in late 1952 at the Festival of California Living. And this was prior to Disneyland, and Walt was kind of using this also as an opportunity to test whether people would be interested in seeing what Disney had to show them prior to opening up Disneyland.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Is this part of, so when I read Jim Corcus's book, that The Vault of Walt, it's either one or two, and I could probably find them. Actually, Pete's got the books. He talks about Walt putting dioramas and miniatures like on tour across the country. And I remember that this was part of it. It was like an exhibit across the country of these miniatures. So that sounds familiar. Like that was one of the scenes that started, and then they said, "Hey, we can actually have people pay across the country to see these." So I remember that.
Yep, and he actually started carving and creating some miniature pieces that he was putting on sale. The people were really fascinated with a particular pot-bellied stove that he had made for one of the dioramas. And so he made a bunch of different versions of the pot-bellied stove and sold them. And one of his pride and joy moments in life was when he found out that that Mrs. James Ward Thorne had, she herself had purchased one of the his miniature pot-bellied stoves for one of her miniature displays. And so that was really a highlight for him.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So this fascination with miniatures was in part of the inspiration for Walton later developing audio animatronics and what would become living dioramas like the Carousel of Progress. He wanted to bring these dioramas to life.
Okay.
And so that was the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. So then we enter into the phase called Edison Square. So this was after Disneyland had opened up. Disneyland was pretty successful in the first few years, and there were plans for expansions. In fact, Walt had actually planned to have some additional streets and branches off of the original Disneyland, but they just couldn't make it work in time and with the budget that they had initially. But with the success, they started to plan for a Main Street expansion. And the plan, this was to accommodate more guests, of course. GE had visited with Walt, General Electric, visited with Walt expressing an interest in sponsoring an attraction at Disneyland that would advertise their products using Walt's storytelling talents. And so putting those two things together, Walt started to run with it, and he came up with the idea of Edison Square. And it was going to be at the end of Main Street, kind of off beside where the Plaza restaurant would be today at Disneyland. It was going to branch off in that direction. And it was going to serve as a transition from the 19th to the 20th century. You would go from, you know, gas lanterns on Main Street to electrical lighting in Edison Square that was all going to be focused around the contributions of Thomas Edison to the growth and development of America.
Okay.
So the plan was to have a horseshoe theater attraction titled Harnessing the Lightning, sponsored by General Electric. And that would have multiple stages that would follow a typical family through the decades, with each step showing how General Electric had made the future brighter and better.
Oh,
and it was gonna be...
okay. I see where this is going at this point already. I see like the seeds of the carousel already.
Absolutely. So the show was to be hosted by an electromechanical man named Wilbur K. Watt. Of course, the K would stand for kilowatt.
Gotcha.
So Wilbur K. Watt was going to host this. And the attraction was announced to open at Easter of 1959. So, I mean, he was announcing it. It was going to happen. It even started showing up on Disneyland maps as early as 1958. But the project never actually came to fruition. The technology wasn't adequate to meet Walt's expectations for that attraction. And he would rather scrap it than to do it lower than his expectations.
You know, he did that a few times for attractions, and of course, they're escaping me right now, but I remember reading clearly that he was frustrated that the technology didn't exist really to go and fully encompass what he wanted to do. As a matter of fact, you know, I think part of that actually works with the Tiki Birds, where he wanted the Tiki Birds to be interactive with people during dinner time. And it was supposed to be a dinner theater, but the technology really didn't exist, so he kind of made his own technology where, you know, he bought this bird down in Mexico, as I remember the story. So please don't kill me if the story's wrong. But he bought the bird in Mexico, brought it back, told his Imagineers to go and take the bird apart, figure out how it worked and how we can use it to go and have a really nice attraction and an interactive attraction. But it didn't really work like he wanted it to. So he was tough on that stuff. He just didn't settle for mediocre or yeah, it kind of works. It was all or none for him on a lot of these things.
Absolutely. And that was what drove he pushed more for the Tiki Bird vision than at that point. He scrapped the Edison Square project, but the desire to make the Tiki Bird room happen continued. And that's what drove the process to develop the concept of audio animatronics. And that's actually a term that I think, you know, was developed by Disney.
Okay.
Audio animatronics. And so eventually, and it was based off of that bird. I heard it was New Orleans where he purchased it.
Oh, it might have been New Orleans. You're right. It might have been New Orleans. I'm sorry. You're right. It wasn't in Mexico.
That's right.
Maybe I was confusing him going down to Mexico and South America. You're right. I'm sorry.
So they developed that technology, and they continued to build upon it, and their audio animatronic technology grew. So in the meantime, Disney began developing during these post-Edison Square years, General Electric had come into some bad publicity on their own. The U.S. Justice Department had charged them with price fixing on their electronic products, and they had to pay out like $500,000 in fines and I think about $50 million in damages to customers. So it was a tough time for General Electric. And then when the World's Fair came around, General Electric was looking for an opportunity to rebuild their brand, to reestablish themselves and fix this bad publicity. So they, of course, wanted to approach Walt Disney, because Walt Disney is associated with quality, with, excellent entertainment. I mean, when you're partnered with Disney, you're going to get something good and successful, and people aren't going to be worried about it. So they went to...
You're right. At that time, Tim, he was. I mean, there was nothing negative associated with Walt, except for, he was a ruthless hard worker, and he was dedicated. So, unlike today, where if you pair up with somebody, you never know what happens. You the media finds stuff all the time. There wasn't a fear with Walt Disney at that time at all.
No, absolutely not. And I'm maybe jumping ahead a little bit, but that's why Disney was actually part of four different projects at the 1964 World's Fair. It wasn't just General Electric, but I'll get to that in a little bit more depth later. So Walt jumped at the chance to, again, develop this relationship with GE, and he quickly revived the idea of the Edison Square proposal, because now the technology was in place that they could do something closer to what he had envisioned in the first place. They revised the script. They came up with an innovative new theater design, and they had newly developed audio animatronic technology. So they put together their proposal, sent it off to GE, and everything was going to go well. In addition to possibly reviving his project, Walt was also planning to use this. He was always testing. He was a smart man. He was going to use this as a gauge to see if East Coast audiences were as dialed into the Disney vision and interested as the West Coast was. So starting to think about a concept of maybe a Disneyland East at that point, and the World's Fair being in New York was a great opportunity to do that.
Tim, so this is a genius business move. So you've got these ideas, but you're also conscious of the costs. You get GE to come by and says, we want to partner with you. We want to go and piggyback your reputation. Okay, so Walt's probably thinking, and I don't ever... imagine I would know what Walt's thinking, but in this case, it's probably accurate. Okay. But you're doing all the funding. So we've got GE paying the bill and Walt with the creative genius in the ride. So, what a great partnership that is if GE's doing all the funding at this point.
Yeah, at that point, that was a great opportunity for them.
Mm-hmm.
So Walt enlisted, he had to put together this proposal to convince the General Electric company that his idea was one that they should get behind. So who else for him to get involved in the project than Richard and Robert Sherman to write a song that to serve as the inspirational glue for this proposed attraction. And the song turned out to be the iconic song that, most of us know, A Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow. And that was the first time it was kind of unveiled to GE, and they loved it. So the proposal was sent to them, and it actually featured Walt and the Sherman brothers singing together in the proposal, as well as Walt explaining the concept of the show and the theater in the round idea. When they got done singing the song, the Sherman brothers actually got up from the piano and were walking away, and they had little General Electric symbols on the back, and they were kind of doing a kicking up their heels thing. It was really cute and clever. GE, of course, fell for the project or for the proposal. They agreed to it, and the development of the pavilion, which was known as Progress Land, the overall pavilion in New York was Progress Land, and it featured the Carousel of Progress. And that project began moving forward at that point.
hence the word Progress Land, which we see a few times in the Magic Kingdom and in Walt Disney World, or this just kind of this ethereal world that kind of word that exists in like the Disney community. There's the basis for it right there.
Yep. So Progress Land and the Carousel of Progress opened on April 22nd, 1964 in Queens, New York, where the World's Fair was being held. It ran there until October 17th of 1965 when the World's Fair closed. The attraction was to be a showcase for GE products, of course. They hoped to show that they had a history of innovative products and that they would people could continue to rely on them to work on even greater products as they would move forward in the future. Audiences would enter the pavilion by taking a speed ramp up to the second floor of the three-story building. And this is where the Carousel of Progress theaters were. There were six theaters. One was for loading, four theaters for the show, and then this sixth theater was for unloading. Okay. And they could load about 200 people every time it went through. So it was ridiculous numbers. I don't remember what the actual number of people that were that they could load into there every day. It was a very fast loading ride, and it was still over an hour wait to get onto this attraction. Wow. And it was a free attraction. Not all the attractions at the World's Fair were free, but GE made and Disney made this a free attraction. So it was someplace that families could go and not have to spend a lot of money, but still get to be part of the excitement of the World's Fair. So audiences would go up the speed ramp to the second floor. They'd experience the Carousel of Progress theaters. There are four stages that remained fixed in positions while the theater seats rotated clockwise around the stages. At the end of each scene, the audience remained seated as the stage moved to the next scene. Scene one was set in the 1890s around the turn of the century during the pre-electric era. Scene two was set in the 1920s. Scene three was set in the 1940s. And then scene four at that time was set in the 1960s.
You said clockwise, right, Tim?
Yeah.
Okay. So immediately that's different already.
Yeah, that was... It was clockwise there, and it was clockwise in its next iteration at Disneyland, but it changed to counterclockwise when it turned up or ended up in Disney World later.
Okay. I apologize for interrupting you.
No, that's okay. Another thing that I just a little tidbit that I caught my attention. Most resources refer to the first scene as just being around the turn of the century in the 1890s, but when I watched that video on YouTube of the Disneyland goes to the World's Fair, Walt was actually in the scene and he was interacting and they were doing kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the Carousel of Progress. And he actually went up to the host, the father character in the scene and asked him, hey, what's the date on this newspaper? And he said 1890. So in my mind, if Walt said it was exactly 1890, it was 1890.
It's 1890. Yep. That's right. Sure.
All right. So the narrator of this was going to be the famous singing cowboy of the time. His name was Rex Allen, and he was featured as the father's voice as well as the narrator and the singer of the song, which at that point was A Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow. And he hosted each scene of the attraction.
Okay.
After exiting the final scene, in the theater, after scene four, audiences were invited to go up to the third floor of the pavilion, which was to view GE's Sky Dome Spectacular, is what it was called. And it was kind of a planetarium-type presentation where GE projected images of the many ways that they were producing electricity and harnessing the power of the sun for their consumers.
It's like the universe of energy meets the Carousel of Progress, but all under GE's umbrella.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. So at the end of the spectacular presentation, then people would go down to the first floor of the pavilion where they could witness, and this I had to really check on this several times to make sure I didn't get this wrong, a demonstration of controlled thermonuclear fusion.
Get they actually out. Did it.
No, they did a nuclear fusion, and it happened like every 4 minutes. They did it on a regular loop. So they were doing a nuclear...
No, people. No glasses, no protection needed. Get close. Get close and see.
Exactly. There are stories about people, you know, just getting startled every 4 minutes because, you know, no matter where you were, you heard that boom. And I guess there was a huge splash of light and a big boom. And I don't know if we know exactly how hot the temperature was. It started off in 1964. They're advertising this and claiming it was like around 20 million degrees.
Holy
and then
cow.
Later on, like in 1965, it was kind of like a fish story, I think. It was like a 50 million degree. I don't know. It was hot. That's all I know.
Tim, there are warning labels on kids' suckers nowadays, but back in 1964, we encourage you to see our thermonuclear fusion reaction, unprotected, without any vision protection.
I wonder if there's a reason why that was on the first floor rather than the second, third floor. I don't know.
All right.
So that was how they would end their experience at the GE Progressland Pavilion. Now, this was not, as I mentioned earlier, this was only one of four projects at the fair. Disney was also partnered with a couple of other companies. They partnered with Ford to do the Magic Skyway, which, as I said, was sponsored by Ford, and audiences boarded vehicles that were designed like new Ford vehicles, and they traveled through time, beginning in the time of dinosaurs and ending in like a futuristic town full of Ford innovations. Small World was actually developed initially for this project as well, and that was a partnership between Pepsi and UNICEF. And then Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln was a display sponsored by the state of Illinois. So they were involved in all four of those projects, and all of them involved audio animatronics in some way.
Walt's making out like a bandit here. He's got Ford paying for it, he's got Pepsi paying for it, and the state of Illinois paying for it. He's doing well. A lot of, you know, attraction research, a lot of data from audiences. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the agreement was that after the World's Fair is over, he keeps everything, and he could bring it back into his park. But, you know, for that process, for those 18 months or 16 months, it's World's Fair property, but he gets to keep it afterwards.
Yeah, there was some speculation at first, and I'm not sure what the roots of this were, that maybe they would leave those attractions there in New York and develop a Disneyland East on that location, but that never worked out. So when the fair closed in October of 1965, the attractions, as you said, they packed them up and they moved them to California with the hopes of integrating them into Disneyland. So like you said, other people paid for it, and Walt was able to benefit from it.
Always a businessman.
Yeah. One little side note, I saw an interview with Bob Gurr, Imagineer Bob Gurr, and he had talked about this, and he talked about the different levels of audio animatronics. All four of these projects were at the 1964 World's Fair, but they were developed in different time frames, and they were making such strides in audio animatronics that the four different projects had very different levels of sophistication of their audio animatronics. So Ford, their audio animatronics were much more scaled back or much more primitive, I guess, compared to, I think, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln was probably the most sophisticated. But Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln had the least amount of time to develop, and so but it was latest to develop, so they had the best technology at that time.
Gotcha.
All right. So what happens then? As we said, it went to Disneyland. So the Carousel of Progress opened at Disneyland on July 2nd, 1967. With some updates, GE had agreed to continue the sponsoring the attraction in Disneyland. And when the show debuted on the first, they created a new building again. On the first floor of the large building of Tomorrowland was where the show was going to be. And the show remained in large part the same with just a few refurbishments. They had a new voice for Mother that was recorded. I don't know why, but for some reason they needed to change the voice for Mother. The 1960s scene was updated with new technology and set design. references to GE's Medallion Home campaign that they had really tried to promote during the World's Fair, they were removed. I guess it had taken off like they had hoped it would, this advertising campaign. And the last update really was the 1940s father was now sitting on a bar stool instead of whatever he'd been sitting on initially.
Okay.
So upon exiting the theater after scene four in Disneyland, audiences were invited to take a speed ramp again up to the second floor, where they would watch a 4-minute presentation that was hosted by father and mother on Progress City. This was a 6,900 square foot model city, and it was Walt's original vision for what we know today as Epcot. So it, that was
you it. Said 6,900 square feet?
6,900 square feet, yes.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it was huge.
Huge.
A portion of that, a small portion of that, can still be seen today. They, if you've ever taken the Tomorrowland Transit, which we call People Mover more affectionately, that when you go, I think it's above what was Stitch's Great Escape, there's a small part that shows part of Epcot model, and that is from that original Progress City, but it's just a tiny part of it.
Yeah, 16. So to give you an idea, most people's homes are between 1,200 and 1,500 square feet. The you know, an average home. So this is four times the size of a person's home if it's 6,900 square feet. Holy cow!
Yeah, he was nothing but if not detailed and precise in all of his plans.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So. So they opened up, and it was doing well at Disneyland at first, but by the early 70s, attendance was starting to drop off at Disneyland, and General Electric was doing statistical analysis, and they estimated that about 80% of the people that were visiting were locals, and they weren't interested in revisiting the attraction repeatedly. So in an effort to reach a broader audience, GE approached Roy Disney, who was in charge of the company at the time, and asked about moving the attraction to Walt Disney World in Florida, which was still in its infancy at that time. And Disney agreed to the move.
Okay. So, Tim, those numbers are probably still accurate. That's why Disneyland's thought of as the locals park, and Walt Disney World is thought of as the vacation kingdom of the world. You know?
Yep. So,
okay.
Yeah, and it was a smart business move by GE, but... Here's where we start to see, you know, the maybe it's not a negative, but it definitely you got the benefits of your partnership with GE, but now they're calling the shots, and maybe it puts a little bit different spin on things. You know, Disney company has to kind of defer to the sponsor in some ways, and I'm sure that they would have preferred to not have to pack it up and move it across country, but it made sense for them, for GE, and so they did it. So in 1973, on September 9th, 1973, Carousel of Progress closed at Disneyland. It was packed up, and it was moved across country to Disney World in Florida, which is where it still is today. It reopened on January 15th, 1975, and it had significant differences at this point in its new iteration in Disney World. So the 1975 updates included... GE wanting to change the focus of the attraction to the concept of now rather than tomorrow, because that's when they want their customers buying products. They want them buying it now, not waiting to see the next coolest thing in the future. Okay. So they wanted to completely change the focus, which meant changing the song. And so Disney had to turn again to the Sherman Brothers to come up with a new song, and it was called The Best Time of Your Life.
All completely makes sense. Why that song and just the title alone would... correspond to the new focus of the attraction.
Yeah. Gotcha. And in fact, in the song, if you've heard it, the song actually says, now is the time, now is the now is the best time of your life. So a lot of people think it's actually called Now is the Best Time of Your Life, but it's not. It's shortened. Sherman Brothers did it because it was their job, but they were really kind of disappointed in that because they had always saw a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow as the theme song for Walt Disney himself. It encompassed his vision and his spirit most completely. But you got to go with what the corporate sponsor wants. So they opened up, or they redid the song. A new one-story theater was constructed in Magic Kingdom, Tomorrowland, that no longer featured a post-show demonstration. And as we said, this theater was going to move in the counterclockwise way instead of clockwise.
Tim, any news about bringing the thermonuclear reaction fusion machine to Walt Disney World at this point?
Yeah, I think that kind of stayed in New York.
they left it? Okay.
It may still be there. Who knows? 3 Mile Island? I don't know. What?
Perhaps.
So that was another one of the changes. The voice of the father was re-recorded. No longer was it Rex Allen, but it was another singing cowboy, I guess. His name was Andrew Duggan. They changed the breed dog. I'm not sure why, but they must have had a reason for that.
Can you recall what did the dog look like in the first in the video?
I've been able to find a video of the original versions at Disneyland or at the 64 World's Fair.
Okay.
I've seen some earlier versions of it at Disney World, but so I don't know what it was like at first.
You know what? I know just the man to send the email to find out the breed of dog. We've just had him on. I'll contact Jim Corcus. We'll get the answer.
Excellent. And another change was that they changed the final scene from Christmas to a New Year's theme. Now, the Christmas tree has stayed in scene forever, so they never got rid of the Christmas tree, but they changed it to a New Year's Eve theme in a 1970s home.
Why do you think that was, Tim? Why do you think they went from Christmas to New Year's?
I honestly don't. I've thought about that. My only thought would be that they were trying to be, you know, New Year's would be less polarizing, maybe for, you know, people of different, you know, faiths, possibly.
Possibly. That's the first thing that pops in my head. Is you're right. It seems that everyone kind of celebrates New Year's at that time, though there is different New Year's celebrations for all different cultures as well too. But New Year seems to cross that border. It's not so polarizing like a religious holiday like Christmas. So
yeah,
okay.
So that was in 1975. So it reopened on January 15th, 1975, and ran with these new changes. They updated it in 1981. Wasn't major changes. They kept the same song. They wrote a new script for the final scene to portray New Year's Eve again in a 1980s home. So a pretty quick update, go from 1975 to 1981, just 6 years, but they updated it and to reflect the new technology of the 80s. But the rest of the show pretty much remained unchanged. They did the same thing in 1985, but this was driven because GE sponsorship actually expired in 1985, and they chose not to renew their sponsorship. So they closed the ride briefly in 1985, so that the GE references, or most of them, could be removed from the attraction. There are still, even to this day, a few GE logos you could look for and find that remain in the attraction. For instance, the logo on the refrigerator in Act 3, I believe, is a GE logo still.
Gotcha. Okay, so sponsors out, let's get rid of the logos, and we'll open it back up. Okay.
Yep. All right, so, but then it stayed the same. Other than removing the GE references, it was pretty much the same show. Then in 1993, they did extensive updates again. On August 16th, the attraction of 93, the attraction closed for refurbishment in order to better reflect the new theme of New Tomorrowland that they were developing. It was the theme of the future that never was, which I've thought about that several times, and I can't really wrap my head around what that was supposed to mean, but the future that never was. Gears and other mechanical symbols were going to be a major feature of the decor at that time. The attraction was renamed in honor of Walt. They called it Walt Disney's Carousel of Progress, and it remains that way still today, as an homage to Walt himself. The song was was brought back to it. The song A Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow was reinstated as the theme for the attraction, and which made the Sherman Brothers really happy.
Mm-hmm.
A new cast was hired for recordings. They hired Gene Shepard to voice the father and to narrate the pre-show history of the attraction.
Gene Shepard, most commonly known from where, Tim?
Christmas Story.
Christmas Story. Okay.
Yep.
Watch TNT from December 5th through roughly December 26th, and I guarantee you'll see Christmas Story no less than how many times, Tim, would you see it on TNT and TBS?
800,000, maybe?
800,000. Pretty accurate. Okay.
Without, you know, taking my shoes off to count,
You'll shoot your eye out. Okay, here we go.
So Gene Shepard was the narrator. They did actually, as a kind of a throwback, Rex Allen, the original father narrator, he was brought back for the new cast recording, and he was going to voice the character of the grandfather.
Okay.
The final scene was updated again to reflect Christmas. They went back to Christmas, and they made the title of the final scene was Christmas in the House of 2000s, which is a little strange because they were doing it in 1993.
Yeah,
they were trying to project out to what the house of for a family in the 2000s would look like in 1993.
But it will never be because it's the future that never was. So these are all like futuristic you know, theoretical ideas that will probably never come to pass. Little did they know.
Yeah. So, and they actually did a pretty good job if you think about it. If you think about that scene from a 1993 perspective, they talk about high-def television, which was, you know, I didn't hear about high-def television until probably, what, 10 years ago or so?
Yeah.
But they also talked about laser discs and car phones.
And talking to your appliances, absolutely.
Yeah, like smart homes. It's really actually very, very right on, and yet so far off in some other areas. It's kind of an interesting mishmash.
My guess is Jeff Bezos at some point saw the Carousel of Progress and thought, that'd be really cool for like a speaker or something along those lines. All right,
so this is the update that remains in place still to this day. There have been a few small cosmetic and mechanical refurbishments that have taken place, but nothing that changes the story from 1993 up till 2018.
Yeah, I could recall a few like refurbishments, but that is like it just goes down maybe some freshening up of the characters and whatnot, maybe some replacing of some appliances or parts, you know, as far as, you know, pneumatic hoses and whatnot. So, but yeah, I know it stays largely the same.
Yeah. So that in a nutshell is the history of the Carousel of Progress. Of course, as you know, there are so many resources. I could have gone on so many different side tangents and it took me longer than I wanted to in the first place, but there's a lot of information out there, but that's the overview of Carousel of Progress.
Okay. I've got a few questions and I wrote them down earlier. So when the Carousel of Progress left Disneyland, what went in? Cause I mean, the building still exists. The actual round building still exists, and they were using it for a. Correct me. I mean, I might have made a mistaken statement there, but I swear I was in there with it was a meet and greet for the Star Wars characters. But what went in when the carousel left?
Well, initially they repurposed it for an exhibit that was called America Sings.
Okay.
And it was another audio animatronic show that was supposed to take visitors on a history of American music, and it was going to go through different eras of American music, and it was hosted by, I wish I'd written it down. I don't remember the name of the character, but it was like a Sam Eagle kind of, not the Muppet, but similar kind of character.
Okay.
That was the host of this America, the America Sings. And so it took them through using the theater, the rotating theater, concept. They still did that, and each theater was a focus on different eras of American music.
Cool. Okay.
One little side note, it's kind of a sad note, but there was actually a fatality at America Sings, and just within a few months after it opened, one of the cast members actually stepped back into a gap or fell, or we don't know exactly.
I heard about this. Yeah.
It fell into a hole, and it was actually, you know, crushed between the walls when it rotated. Mm. So, I think that's the only one that is associated with either of these exhibits, but kind of a sad side note to the story.
You might not know, how long did America Sings last then in that theater?
I think it ran, I believe I heard that it lasted like 13 or 14 years, something like that.
Wow.
It was much longer than you would have expected.
Yeah, staying power. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, at the time it opened, it was perfect because it was right around America's bicentennial the bicentennial for America in 1976 was huge. I wasn't old at the time, but I still remember it a little bit. And so it was perfect for that time, but it you would have thought it would have become outdated pretty quickly, but they kept it going for quite some time.
Okay. And then let me ask you this much. So now we've got the Carousel of Progress, and you would have done the research. I've heard about that. And at the Walt Disney World property, there actually was an attraction that was considered a sequel. What do you know about that?
I believe you're referring to Horizons that opened at Epcot.
I am. Tell me what you know about that, because in a way, when you first make that statement, you're like, get out. And then you think about it, and it actually makes sense when you put the pieces together.
Yeah, it was supposed to, and I sadly never got a chance to experience it. And in my research, I haven't run across any videos of Horizons. I need to do a more thorough search. I'd like to see if there is anything out there. But Horizons was supposed to be like a sequel, and it was sponsored by General Electric too. They had dropped the sponsorship of Carousel of Progress, I think in part because they had this project going that they were opening at Epcot on Horizons.
Where it dealt with life in futuristic locations in one of three different locations. So, okay, that would make sense that instead of taking you from the past up to the current day, it takes you into the future. So I guess it's a stretch to say it's a sequel, but you could kind of see how that lineage stretches a little bit into Horizons.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me ask you this much. So we've got the final scene, and albeit it looks a little dated right now, what would you do with that final scene at this point?
Man, I have gone back and forth in my own mind over and over and over that. It definitely needs some updating. But you know, how do you update it? Do you go and you update to a scene of, you know, 2020s? So your last jump is from 1940 to 2020. Mm-hmm. You know, 80-year gap. I don't know if that's what we should do, or if you just I really don't know. I'm afraid that it's going to lose something with audiences as we get older, and as it gets older, I don't want to lose it, but I don't want to lose its spirit by changing it too much either. So I really don't know how to go about that.
Okay, let me propose a scenario to you. Let me solve your problem. Okay, and this might take the hands of a really talented Imagineering crew. What if you kept it just as it is, but what if you decrease the size of the theater and each showpiece, and you actually had 5 rotations, and you covered yourself, 1890, 1920, 1940, you know what I'm saying? And what if you had kept it, and that was the view of the world back 10 years ago, and what if you put one of the view of the world 20 years from now, and you showed some progress in there? Now, it would be a major change because you're obviously decreasing the size of the theater and the capacity of the attraction itself because you're essentially taking the ride vehicle and making it smaller as well. But, I mean, the space is limited as X number of feet, but why not just make each theater just a little smaller? You could keep it because you're right. 1890s, 1920s, 1940s, 2020, like that segue is a bad segue, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay.
I think My gut tells me that Disney's probably not going to put the money into
a project like that. I agree. That's a major refurbishment.
I think it would have to get another sponsorship from somebody like, you know, Apple or Amazon or somebody that would be wanting to come in and do a sponsorship like that. But I think that that's a great idea. The one drawback to that is, you know, we no longer have Gene Shepard, or unfortunately, as the voice of the narrator. So we would have to, we would either have to re-record all of the scenes with a new narrator or keep Gene Shepard's voice and the others and then just use new voices for the final scene.
Yeah.
But that's the best compromise of an idea that I can think of.
Hmm. See, that at least had one good idea.
Yeah.
All right.
I've got somebody in mind, but who would you, if you were going to re-record with a new narrator, you have a voice in mind that you think would be perfect for it?
Okay, so this conversation might go off in a different direction, but that's a very difficult thing to ask right now, and I'll explain why. Because even when you have a celebrity that you perceive as safe, it's not. So, for example, you know, do you know who used to voice the narration of like the Vancouver Public Railroad system or the Vancouver Public Railway, whatever that was?
No.
Morgan Freeman.
Really?
And within days, it was pulled. So you have to be careful when you ally when you partner up with a person, you have to be careful. You acquire all of that person's ability.
Yeah.
So it's possible that you find a voice actor that sounds like Gene Shepard or heck, even Walt himself. But I don't know if I'd be too quick to go and partner up with a voice actor. However, I would go off the table here. If you told me I had to pick a person, I've always been a fan, and she is hysterical, she's emotional, and I truly believe she's a good person, and it just so happens that she no longer has an attraction. But I think Ellen would make an amazing narration for the Carousel of Progress.
That would be a cool way to go.
And she would have a cool factor that the ride doesn't have right now, with a little bit of humor involved that it doesn't currently have.
Yeah. I like that. That's not a bad idea.
Who would you think, buddy?
I was thinking Tom Hanks.
Oh, that's a good choice.
You know, the most fatherly Disney figure I could think of the time. But, yeah. You know, the closest thing we have to Walt himself, you know, he played Walt in Saving Mr. Banks. So
that was
my thought. But I wouldn't mind a new direction with Ellen either. That would be good. I don't know that's either of those is going to ever happen.
Yeah.
Real quick, since we're talking about voices, I wanted to throw in a couple other little side nuggets of random facts. Mel Blanc, who was most famous for voicing Looney Tunes voices, like Bugs Bunny and others. What character is he? Do you know?
Oh, man, I saw this earlier, but I don't recall it now. Shoot. Okay, so was he Orville?
Yes.
It would make sense because of his Orville's goofy voice and his goofy inflections. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, he is. And actually, I think it's the 1940s scene, the radio cuts in with some like news stories, and I believe that's his son that is the voice of those as well. Or it might have been him. I wouldn't want anybody to quote me on either of those, but I know there was a connection to either him or his son. Another voice, maybe not as recognizable to people, but the grandma in the 1990 or the New Year's of the 2000s scene, she is, her name was Janet Waldo, and she was the voice of Judy Jetson in The Jetsons.
Whoa. That's a cool tidbit for sure.
Yeah. And the last little nugget that really just caught my attention was in the very first scene in the springtime in the 1890s, the scene opens with robins chirping in the background. The robins that are in that scene, they are animatronics that were used in the movie Mary Poppins, which I know that you just recently became familiar with.
That's a really cool tidbit.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, brother, you got anything more?
That kind of wraps me up.
Okay. So I tell you what, next time we meet, the beer's on me while we listen to our Al Jolson records, and we get our news straight from who? Who's going to tell us our news, Tim?
It would be, what's his name? John something Swayze.
John Cameron Swayze.
Cameron Swayze, yeah.
That's what we're getting our news story for. Okay. Well, thank you, buddy. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge with me. And, you know, stuff like that really makes you appreciate going to Walt Disney World. Yes, I know that the kids grab onto the IPs nowadays, but it wasn't that long ago that we were kids too, and that's what we remember. And then you learn the history behind it, and it brings you all the closer. So I really appreciate you sharing it with us.
I enjoyed it.
Okay. So if you have any questions, if you know the breed of dog that used to exist before he was changed, or if you have any comments, feel free to contact us contact me on the WDW Reviews Facebook page, or you can contact Tim directly. Tim, where can they reach you?
The easiest place is probably through the Edcot space on Facebook. I'm frequently found around there. I am on Facebook. You can look me up, Tim Vanswall, on Facebook.
Awesome. And you mentioned Edcot. We appreciate that. That's the private Facebook group for essentially the listeners of the show, and it's just a great community of people. So I appreciate that. So for my buddy Tim and for myself, we appreciate you downloading and listening, and we hope you have a great day.
Thanks for joining us. Thank you for joining us on Walt Disney's Carousel of Progress. We hope you've enjoyed this tribute to the 1964 Carousel of Progress from the New York World's Fair. Please gather all of your personal belongings and exit through the doors located at the back of the theater. Have a great big beautiful day. And remember, tomorrow is just a dream away.